This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk about aviation cybersecurity with a notable expert in the field. In the news, we look at an NTSB report about the failure to share weather-related information with pilots, United Airlines ties executive compensation to customer satisfaction, European aviation cybersecurity initiatives, and oxygen generation troubles for a military jet trainer. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 449 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'm joined by, well, a bunch of co-hosts. We were trying to think of the word that goes with co-hosts. It starts with a C, and we came up with one. So we have a chattering of co-hosts. And the first one that we'll introduce is Rob Mark. He's the senior editor at Flying Magazine. He's a flight instructor, and he publishes the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
How come I just knew when you talked about that chattering, you were going to go to me first? I just knew it. But welcome to everybody, everywhere, wherever you are. We're happy to have you here.
Also joining us is Max Trescott, the other Max, Max West. He's a CFI, an author, a glass cockpit expert, and also now a podcast producer.
Hey, and an expert on collective nouns. So we were trying to figure out which noun would be a group of us. So that was a chattering of starlings. But fortunately, we are not a murder of crows. Isn't that one weird?
That is a very
murder?
Strange one.
I mean, that makes no sense to me.
All right. Well, to help make sense of things, we have Brian Coleman, our associate producer, with us. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Max. Hello, everyone. I proposed a cuckoo's nest, and no one liked that one. So.
That works,
No,
too.
I loved it. No, it's great.
Our final co-host
I'll keep looking.
Is David Vanderhoof. He's our aviation historian and man about military aviation. Hi, David. How are you?
I'm good. Sorry I missed the show last week. We had Skype issues, so I decided to go buy a new computer to fix that. So I'm looking forward to having stress-free Skype calls again.
Yay. Okay, that's great. Yeah, we missed you last week, David. It's terrible that we couldn't bring you into the call, but it seems like the new computer has solved the problem. So off we go.
Yep, you sound good now.
Well, our guest this episode is Dr. Remzi Seeker. Now, he's professor in the Department of Electrical, Computer, Software, and Systems Engineering at the Embry-Riddle College of Engineering. He's also director of the Cybersecurity and Assured Systems Engineering Center, that goes by Sybase. And he has expertise in cybersecurity, of course, privacy and computer networks, as well as integrated systems, embedded system security, cybersecurity in aviation and aerospace systems, cybersecurity in automobiles, and also digital forensics. Remzi's here to talk with us about aviation cybersecurity. So, Remzi, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Now, if you're wondering how we came to have Remzi here with us, you might recall an email that we had from a listener, Aya, in Turin, Italy. And she sent along a link to a video, a panel discussion of aviation cybersecurity. And Remzi was part of that panel. So we reached out to Embry-Riddle, and now he's here with us. Well, Remzi, I think that panel discussion was almost exactly a year ago. Would you say that interest in aviation cybersecurity is about the same as last year? Has it grown since last year? What are your thoughts?
Oh, it has certainly grown, because since then, if you recall, there was an incident about somebody tweeting what they had done. They had basically splashed into the entertainment system and then claimed that they hacked into the airplane. And then an FBI agent who wrote the report basically put it in the report that he made the airplane fly sideways and all that jazz. So, yes. And that was a, I would say that was an event that drew a lot of attention. And of course, since then, there has been some further attacks against airports and such that have been documented. So yes, certainly there has been a tremendous amount of attention diverted through aviation and especially commercial aviation cybersecurity.
Well, we're really, really pleased to have you here. We're going to have a terrific conversation. I know I'm really looking forward to it. We all are. And first, we're going to start off with a little bit of aviation news from the past week. So I'll ask, is everyone ready?
Yeah. Ready.
Ready from the West.
Our first story comes from Flying Magazine. Actually, Rob penned this. NTSB calls for changes to PIREP creation and dissemination education efforts. So the NTSB has found that failure by air traffic control to share weather-related information with pilots is a weakness in the system. And the NTSB has recently released a report about this. Rob, most people listening already know, but can you tell us first what a PIREP is and what's going on here?
Well, a PIREP is a pilot report. It's essentially something that someone that is out flying, you know, picks up the microphone or keys their headset and calls flight service or air traffic or somebody on the ground and says, ah, here's a weather phenomenon that I am experiencing, you know, poor visibility when it was forecast to be good, or bumpiness where it was intended to be smooth, just about anything that you can think of, unexpected winds, just, again, pretty much anything related to weather. And what the NTSB found, and let's be, I want to be clear about one thing. It's not just air traffic that they're picking on here. They're really picking on everybody, all of us that fly included, because it's not just air traffic's job to disseminate the pilot reports, but it's our job as pilots to make certain that we're actually sending the reports down to the ground. And not enough of us do that. And I, in fact, I was talking to our buddy Max T out there to the west and a number of other flight instructors over the last few days. And none of us really focus on PIREPs very much, other than telling pilots that they're out there and that they should try to get them when they can to see what the weather's like ahead of them. But I think from what the NTSB said, all of us, instructors included, pretty much stink at teaching people how to create PIREPs. And then it got back into the how do they get disseminated or not get disseminated. So the NTSB really took everybody to task, I think, on this one. But the goal is to essentially make sure that the weather that's out there that is in between forecasts and in between METAR reports and all that sort of thing, that could be significant, that could help someone, that could prevent an accident, actually gets sent out to the rest of the world so we know what's going on.
And PIREPs can be created by any sort of pilot, correct?
Oh, absolutely.
Commercial, GA, yeah.
Sure, and you know, Max T, you'll probably remember the days when we used to get our weather briefings on the telephone. We actually called and spoke to a live body, and the last thing they would always say is, and by the way, we're up on 220, be sure to send us a PIREP if you see anything. And but since we don't have that kind of human interaction anymore, that little reminder is gone. And, you know, Max T, let me ask you, I mean, I don't know if you've talked about this at all this week, but do you find a lot of the people that you fly with understand how to create a PIREP or where to send it or that sort of thing?
Oh, I think they probably know that the best way to do it is to contact flight service. I think the problem is that people will sometimes pass it along to air traffic control. You're talking to approach control or center, and they don't, I think, absolutely have to pass it along. And I get the sense sometimes when talking with them, they're like, yeah, thank you very much, and then kind of move on. So I worry that PIREPs that are handed directly to an air traffic controller may not get passed along. If you do contact flight service, for sure they are supposed to publish that. And I must say, to me, the most fun thing, and I don't give PIREPs very often, but it's always kind of fun to actually see it show up on the map. You know, it's like, hey, we did that one. You know, that's us on the map.
Absolutely. And the example I used in the story was one in which there was some really significant weather down in Florida, and the pilot had taken off on a twin Cessna and was not really told about what was going on en route nor at his destination. And he flew into a cell and lost control, a thunderstorm cell, and lost control as he made a missed approach and crashed. And again, there are other examples out there. But again, that was kind of the point of the entire NTSB report, is to see if we can shake a few cobwebs out of people and make them realize that automation's cool, but there are still live bodies out there that could benefit from knowing what the rest of us are seeing. Sometimes when awful weather is forecast and you get out there and there's nothing there, and that's happened to us as well. So, but, you know, and too, if I can make a pitch, since I'm working on a longer version of that story, if any instructors or pilots have any thoughts about the PIREP system, the way it is or the way it could be or should be, please drop me an email here and Care of the Geeks or rob@jetwine.com, and I'd love to hear what you have to say. So, and as they say in Radioland, over and out.
Okay. Hey, let me add one thing to that, Rob. I think sometimes people think, well, we've got all these other great sources of weather. Are PIREPs really adding that much to it? And I just want to point out there are some things that can be only determined by PIREPs, and tops of clouds, you know, is a really good example. I mean, yeah, you can use the satellite, which gives you the temperature, but oh man, you know, the resolution on that's going to be thousands of feet. So, you know, it's really helpful for the local tower to know that, oh, pilots are going to pop out at 2100. So PIREPs are really excellent for that. In fact, today I departed IFR and the tower said, you know, would appreciate a bases and tops report. So that's a PIREP. Hmm.
And of course, we'll have a link in the show notes to the NTSB special investigation report, so you can take a look at that and see what they had to say directly. All right, next item. This is from the BBC. United Airlines to tie executive pay to customer satisfaction.
What a concept!
Isn't that
exactly
great?
Right on, right on.
I didn't mean to be so loud.
you pegged the meters, Rob.
Sorry.
I
want
to know how they define customer satisfaction.
Oh, there you go, Brian. Good question.
There's the key. Yeah, certainly, executive compensation packages really do, in my experience, really do drive behavior. Because these guys at the top of the heap, at the top of these companies, these corporations, if they meet their objectives, their goals, then you're typically talking about millions of dollars potentially in compensation, stock options or whatever it is. And so it really, really does drive behavior. So if someone is, you know, that incented to drive customer satisfaction, you're going to see something happen. That's for sure. But boy, what a great point. How does United in this particular case define customer satisfaction? It's, you know, you use the words and you kind of say, well, I know what that means, but how you measure it, that's tough.
Let's start off with basics, like going a whole week without being a major news story.
which has been tough lately. Of course, we've talked about United a lot, and now we see something going on with American.
Oh, good. So you did see that story then? I was wondering if it made it nationally. We're talking about the incident on either Friday or Saturday. I think it was Saturday morning in San Francisco.
I guess that's where it was. Yeah, with the woman and the stroller and the child and all crying.
Yes.
In the, yes.
Yes, exactly. And I was thinking that one didn't really seem to catch fire like the United one was, but there was a huge difference. I mean, granted, there was a flight attendant who snatched the stroller from her, almost hit the baby, and she's crying. And then there was a confrontation between someone in first class who stood up and really, looked like he was ready to pick a fight with a flight attendant. But what's interesting is by the time that plane had landed in Dallas, I believe American Airlines had already come out with the apology statement, which had some of the same words that United finally used when they got around to the real apology they gave about 48 hours after their incident, talking about, these are not our values and the flight attendant's been suspended and so on. So, I mean, what a great example of kind of crisis management. They were on that so quickly that, that story couldn't catch fire.
But you know what's
interesting? Yeah, they definitely learned by their mistakes. But they learned by United's mistakes. Sorry, Rob.
That's okay. What I was going to say, though, is I wonder if they would have been so quick on the uptake if the event at United hadn't occurred a week before.
Yeah, that's a good question.
I mean, I realize we don't know, but...
Yeah. Well, speed counts for a lot. You know, Remsey, it's probably just like with a threat, a cyber threat of some kind. Speed is going to count for a lot in terms of minimizing the impact. I think it's similar with a cyber threat and a customer the relationship threat.
That is correct. It's threat management 101 or incident management 101. The quickest and the most accurate response is what all of us strive to come up with.
Yes, and it just becomes increasingly important as, we see with social media and the fact that...
Exactly.
Those videos were probably out before that plane even... Well, was that in the air when that incident took place at American? I'm not even sure.
No. They hadn't closed the door there, so yeah, okay. You're right. They may have been posted before the door was closed.
Yeah. We have another item. This is Airbus and SITA join forces to provide advanced cybersecurity services for air transport industry. And what we have is an organization within Airbus called Airbus Cybersecurity. They and SITA have launched a security operations center services, and the idea is that this will, quote, provide airlines, airports, and other air transport industry stakeholders with information about unusual cyber activity that may impact their businesses. Remsey, we were talking a little bit before we started the show. Airbus cybersecurity is not something that's just been now created. They've been active for some time, I guess.
That is correct. So they were actually participant in SC216, the RTCA committee. However, not under the name of SC216 or RTCA, but their group was called WG72, I believe. And the RTCA reports, two of which that the standards that I have worked on the committee for, and I participated in. We did have representatives from Airbus, Dassault Falcon, I believe, and a couple of other European organizations.
Now, the article says that SITA's Airline IT Trends Survey from last year, 2016, shows that 91% of airlines plan to invest in cybersecurity programs over the next 3 years. So I guess back to my question that I asked you at the beginning, Seeker. I mean, this sounds like a real step up in terms of awareness that airlines and airports really do need to get involved in this.
It is. And there is a major conference as well regarding aviation. It's held in Washington, D.C. Every year, the ICNS conference. And I do remember about 3 years ago, I think it was 3, if not 4 years ago, leading people from FAA, from Australia, from Europe, they all basically have come out and said that we have been behind the curve in terms of keeping up with the developments and we need to do something about it. And since then, I've actually seen in this report and this merger or the consortium between SITA and Airbus confirms that as well. That the issue of cybersecurity, and not only for airlines, but for nation states, for the nation states who are in charge of the airspace, I guess, managers. But the nation states as well, and everybody who's in charge of an airspace is now paying attention to importance of cybersecurity as it impacts safety.
And I imagine in this particular case with Airbus Cybersecurity and CETA, am I correct? Maybe you don't know, but am I correct in sort of assuming that this is a sort of a commercial service that they're going to offer, something a service that an airline or an airport could subscribe to probably?
That's what I understood as well. However, the details of the server and how they are going to do the delivery is not clear to me at this time. It, in some sense, it resonated what we already have here in the United States, the AISAC, A-ISAC, which was founded, I believe, in about 2014. And in fact, the person who started it, I believe her name was Fran. Anyway, it was a professional from Boeing. And they were just starting it then, and I was one of the first people actually to be kind of part of that group, if you will. And it has come a long way. It has regular meetings, it has regular teleconferences, it releases, I believe, at least weekly reports of cybersecurity incidents. Not all of them are specific to, say, aviation systems or airports. They are usually cybersecurity threats for regular computer systems and applications, which, of course, then can impact the ground systems we've got, since those also use the commercial systems such as Windows and other operating systems that we use.
It is such a large and fascinating problem or issue, concern. So before we jump into that in more detail, let's just do one more quick news story. This is a military item. Temporary fix identified for T-45C trainer oxygen system failures. Students still can't land on carriers until permanent solution found. So, David, this is about the T-45C Goshawk trainer.
Goshawk, yep.
And they've had some failures with the onboard oxygen generator system. Tell us about what's happening here.
The pilots are suffocating in the airplane.
That's a problem.
It is a problem. And we've had these problems in the past. The T-45 is a derivative of the British Aerospace Hawk that was made by McDonnell Douglas, now Boeing. It was devised, beefed up for naval to replace A-4 Skyhawks, TA-4Js, and T-2C Buckeye. It is the jet trainer that almost everybody these days gets carrier qualified on and gets their wings. The problem is right now, most jet fighters have an onboard oxygen system, and should that system fail, there's usually a warning light to go on, and that doesn't seem to be happening, and the pilots are coming down with hypoxia, which I'm sure that Max Trescott and Rob would understand that is a very dangerous thing. And so they've been keeping the flights under 5,000 feet. They're trying to find out why they're having this issue, but it's preventing a lot of pilots from, they grounded the whole fleet, and it's providing a lot of ground time for our pilot trainees because they don't have the ability to train because they don't have an aircraft to train in.
Did we have a similar problem on the F-35? Is that what I recall?
We did.
Yeah,
One of the original problems with the F-35, given all of them, was the onboard oxygen system and not working properly. That did get fixed. The F-18E and Fs have also had the same problem. Ironically, it's also a Boeing product. So it's just a challenging thing that these are aircraft that have been around a while, and now all of a sudden, it's amazing how suddenly these sort of problems pop up when you're dealing with older aircraft. And T-45s get a lot of abuse because they're the for the United States Navy, the SR-22s of the world, you know. So they are the primary trainer. So And the biggest thing is these pilots aren't able to go out to the carrier and carrier qualify, get their first arrested landing and first assisted takeoff. So interesting story, one we'll watch because it's got ramifications on the whole training pipeline for the United States Navy.
Yeah, that seems huge.
And what is the proper pronunciation? Say it again, David. I didn't catch it.
Of what? A goshawk?
Okay, that's it.
Yeah, the whole family of British airspace are hawks. The goshawk is a water kind of like a bald eagle. It's a hawk that hangs around the water in oceans and fishes. So when they made the hawk, the Navy wanted a naval hawk, so they took the goshawk.
Huh.
That's totally cool.
Yeah, I love those derivations. Well, we're learning words right and left this episode.
Welcome to the English Language Podcast.
That's right. All right, well, let's really jump into the aviation cybersecurity topic with Ramsey Seeker. Ramsey, again, thanks for coming on the show. Let's ask you about how vulnerability may have changed over time. Are aircraft, are airports more vulnerable these days than they have been in the past, or is that kind of a constant?
So I have to tread really lightly here.
Okay.
I have to tread carefully in the sense that the quickest thing media does is they start using this fear factor in some sense, I guess, or blame the people who designed these systems. Fact of the matter is these systems were designed for their time and for the requirements they had to comply. One thing I believe we need to keep in mind is that in the, I would say, and please correct me if this is wrong, in the aviation business, when you design a system, the expected lifetime of the system or the design is about 30 years, if not more.
Right. Yep.
Would you be willing to use a computer that's 30 years old today?
That's a great point, right? You obviously would not, because like you're suggesting, that was designed for a different time. Yes. Yeah.
Correct. So in that regard, when you look at the ACARS system, for example, there is virtually no security built into it. Even the systems that are as recent as ADS-B, the automatic dependent surveillance broadcast, I believe, if I got the acronym right, ADS-B. When you look at it, ADS-B virtually offers no privacy. Well, this is not good for people who own private airplanes, because it may be an airplane that belongs to some, say, celebrity or CEO of United, who is, say, flying from City A to City B, and we may then infer that he or she is flying over there for a business deal. And that is basically business intelligence. It's a simple example that I'm giving. But fact of the matter is that these issues were not considered when these systems were being built. Now, ADS-B itself has some other problems. Nobody thought that you could basically build your own, say, gadget and then start producing fake airplanes, ghost airplanes in the sky, and thereby people who are around you who can receive the signal and they are, say, flying, they would see you on their ADS-B receivers. Hmm. And these are the type of cool problems actually we're working on in our lab, in our center. But I guess the main point is that these systems were not designed to handle these type of issues. And now that the computers are everywhere, and then we have the next generation, the SWIM system. I don't know if you're familiar with that. I can talk about the SWIM system as well. The system-wide information management system, FAA's next gen system. To which, by the way, every airplane is basically now an extension of an on-ground network. And that being the case, so in some sense, we're talking about Internet of Things. Well, okay, an airplane that was built, say, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, they are all part of this network. And so then now we have to look into what is the true attack surface and what kind of attack vectors exist and how somebody could materialize that. So there has to be threat modeling threat modeling at multiple levels, at aircraft level, at the link level, at the ground system level, and even when it comes to ground systems at different at level of different systems and how they interrelate to each other. So in that regard, I hope I didn't confuse anybody. I think in that regard, it's a very complex problem, and it is being addressed, by the way. People are working on it. The question is whether there is enough amount of effort going into it or not.
Ramsey, let me ask you this. In looking at this very difficult problem, what's the approach? Do you find ways to go back and revise old systems to make them more secure, or do you start from the current point, go forward with new systems? How do you approach it?
Great question. So you do both.
Okay.
So here is what you do. You first look at what is coming up, and then you say, from now on, this is what we're going to do. These are the standards we're going to follow, and those are the new RTCA standards, relatively new RTCA standards and more. The AIAA also has a nice framework that they had put out, I believe it was 1 or 2 years ago. So you do that, but at the same time, you look at your existing assets, because the whole infrastructure has been in place for such a long time and such great investments have been made into it. And in some sense, it's working perfectly fine. Then what you do is then you look into how I can build layers around the existing systems to protect them. And that's basically what we do in real life in protecting any type of asset as well. Just think about how long it took us to depart from NTSC into the digital TVs.
Yes, yes. It was a process of years.
Exactly. And the expense even then was prohibitive just to do the switch just like that. And in this case, it's even more because we're talking about aircrafts. We're talking about the infrastructure that exists in ground as well as aerial systems. Hmm.
Is there an economic analysis, an economic trade-off that's made looking at the costs of making the systems more secure versus the risks? Does that come into play?
It does come into play. When we talk about threats or when we talk about vulnerabilities in general, there are a couple of things we take into account. The likelihood of a threat materializing, which means harming us, is certainly one of the factors. The value of the asset is another one. And the third one that we have to also consider is the capability of your potential attacker to be able to exploit, find out and exploit the vulnerability that you have. So those three things have to be considered in prioritizing your vulnerabilities and then addressing them. It is indeed a difficult problem. I am not aware of a specific trait study that has taken this complex system and dissected it in such a way to make this kind of analysis, cost-benefit, so to speak, analysis, and to say that, well, this is what we can do and this is what we cannot do. I do believe, though, part of this analysis and cost-benefit analysis comes into place when the standards are being developed and the solutions are being devised.
You mentioned access to the systems. I'm reminded of my own experience. I go back far enough with computers. So some of the early computer programming I did was on IBM mainframes.
Yes.
Of course, we didn't really have issues with cyber threats because the only people that knew how to interact with the hardware and the software was a very limited group of people. Then you sort of jump forward to the personal computers becoming available, and now access is almost universal, almost global. It's very easy to, well, I won't say it's very easy, but it certainly makes it more possible for people with malicious intent to devise methods of pulling that off, because they have access to the systems, to the software, to the operating systems, and so forth. So when we look at aviation systems, are we somewhat protected because those that may seek to defeat the security don't really have access to those systems? Or is that a false sense of security?
So there is a little bit of that, in the sense that the equipment is not widely available to everybody, so that protects you to some extent. However, any security expert would tell you that that's not really how security should be maintained, which is through obscurity, basically. And it's not going to last long as your security is that way. Sooner or later, somebody's going to get their hands on one of those specialized devices and then penetrate into your system. I would say when it comes to aviation systems, what is saving the day is the practice and the philosophy of safety first when building all the systems. And by that I mean, when you look at, for example, the entertainment system, or when you look at the people browsing the internet from the airplane, all those systems are supposed to be, and I believe they are, segregated from the critical infrastructure that is on the airplane itself, in the sense that the flight control software and hardware is completely isolated from, let's say, I don't want to drop any names and make commercial, but let's say internet access through the airplane infrastructure. And so as long as they are isolated, even if somebody were to try to attack, say, one of those service providers' network, well, so be it. The users will not be able to do their chats or browse Facebook as they are traveling in the airplane.
Yeah, but do we really know that there's an air gap?
Well, I didn't look.
Right. So, that's my fear.
Taking DO-178 BNC, which is the standard that is basically that dictates how the aircrafts are built, I would say that I have certain level of assurance, as long as those standards are followed, that there is an air gap. Now, if we were to refer to the quote-unquote hacker story, or I rather call them cracker, actually, the person who said that he was able to get the GPS coordinates and stuff, well, yes, of course, the entertainment systems do get the GPS coordinates, so that you have that live map to see your aircraft that you're on and see where you are in the world. And so getting the GPS coordinates doesn't really mean that you've got access to aircraft's navigation system. So in that regard, I do believe there is an air gap. Now, I think where things are getting a little bit blurry is that when electronic flight bags are handed to pilots and they are actually being used for purposes of filing PIREPs, and for purposes of flight plans, making flight plans and filing flight plans and so on. And if they are to use this network, then there may be some potential threats.
Yeah, this is something that we've talked about, and I know on other forums there's been a lot of discussion as to whether you can really get access to the flight systems, the control systems from for example, the in-flight entertainment system.
Well, you're not supposed to.
You're not supposed to, yes.
Yeah, and I do believe that the standard dictates isolation. Now, of course, there is also this isolation mean different things to different people. And that is actually one of the challenges for me that I saw between aviation and aviation industry, aviation folks, as well as cybersecurity folks. And you could also see that confusion in the GAO report as well, the Government Accountability Organization. The GAO issued a report on aircraft/aviation cybersecurity, and the report was written by very competent cybersecurity professionals who knew virtually nothing about cybersecurity or aircrafts. And this is not to belittle anybody, or this is not to tear anybody down. But what was what I could also see in the report is that they had consulted some airplane folks. For example, and I have seen this from personal experience when I was working with the SC216 group, the concept of firewall to somebody, say, like Max, who has been in the aviation business for a very long time, is probably completely different, unless that person is a computer expert, is probably completely different than what it means to me. To me, firewall is a very specific piece of software or hardware that blocks certain ports and blocks certain type of traffic from going in and out. How effective is that, et cetera, is a different issue. But to somebody else, a firewall concept may mean actually physical separation like it is done in the forests, because that's where the term has been borrowed from. And so if both of us are talking about firewall, while one of us, meaning, say, Max means, or Brian means, that we're talking about physical isolation, air gap, and I mean that, no, actually, it doesn't have to be air gap. It just can be a piece of code that does the isolation for me in a virtual way. We may be getting along without really knowing what it is we're talking about, or what it is we're agreeing about. And I think that is one of the challenges when cybersecurity and aviation folks get together and start communicating, is that there is quite a bit of confusion out there.
Interesting.
Yeah, I completely agree.
At the beginning of the show, you had said that the FBI had written in a report that the hacker had actually been able to turn the aircraft. Are you saying that was inaccurate?
Yes, it was. Well, okay. I mean, we all know that fixed-wing aircrafts do not fly sideways. Aerodynamically, well, that's not possible. So.
Okay. I thought you meant like knife-edge, 90-degree bank. But,
No.
Yeah. But your point was, no, that they were inaccurate. They did not control the airplane.
Yeah, it was. And all the person was himself saying that that he was receiving, he was receiving navigation information. Well, of course, the entertainment unit indeed receives GPS coordinates, navigational data, because people display them. They like to see them. It's a service that is provided through the entertainment system. However, though, with that, I think I can talk about one of my frustrations, is that in any type of system, you will have people who do what we call as social engineering, and that can include also creating fear in people, because you have a lot of people who just want to brag or whatever their motives may be. In the past, there has been other events. I cannot recall that that person's name, but it was one of the first who basically said that I hacked into this system, I hacked into that system. It turned out that he had just bought a couple of simulators from eBay, and old ones at that. And yes, then he hacked into the simulators. But that doesn't really mean he hacked into the aviation systems in use today. But more than that, though, it took so long for the FAA or any other authority to come out and give satisfactory answers. The first answer was that, no, this is not, it cannot happen, or no, this is not, this claim is baseless, something to that effect. But in the interest of public trust, I believe, when you disvalidate a claim that somebody made, it has to be fact-based. And the information has to be satisfactory enough that when you say this is not possible, there needs to be a little bit of why that is not possible, and without creating any confusion. Because if you say that the entertainment system and the critical systems on the aircraft are, say, protected or are isolated by a firewall, now everybody in the security industry is going to jump on that, because they all know that firewall does not necessarily prevent people or attackers. But for aviation folks, when they are talking about firewalls, again, I keep talking about the firewall example because this is exactly what was used. And when the public is not satisfied, or when there is not clear communication, you're not doing a great job at in establishing trust in your system. And I think I don't even know that we should point fingers, but that was the philosophy behind starting our center. And we still stand by it, that there needs to be a place that can issue this kind of reports to address the concerns and make sure that if there is a problem, the problems are addressed as well. But if the claims are false or if the claims are invalid, the information that is going to ease the public or the industry should also be coming relatively quickly.
Mm, yeah, good point. Remzi, maybe you can spend a little more time talking about the programs at Embry-Riddle that relate to aviation cybersecurity. Tell us a little bit more about the Sybase Center, for example.
Okay, so first the programs. We have an area of concentration in cybersecurity within computer science program. And at the same time, we also have a Master of Science in Cybersecurity Engineering. The undergraduate one is also engineering, and I'd like to talk about the difference between cybersecurity and cybersecurity engineering. We do take the philosophy of engineering cybersecurity into systems rather than just say using some tools to break into systems or using some tools to do some type of auditing on a certain system or just coming up with some policies. We do believe that taking an engineering perspective into producing cybersecurity solutions is going to benefit everybody else. It's going to benefit the industry, but at the same time, it's not something everybody else does. And that being the perspective, we actually do talk about aviation systems and use them as case studies for our classes as well as projects. One of my students, in fact, is a graduate student. He did his master's thesis on ADS-B security. Another student of mine did his master's thesis on UAS as a service, UAV as a service. And he's now continuing on to his doctorate degree. As it comes to Sybase is the center that we have started with people from different domains. We've got people who do hardware circuit design. We've got people who strictly focus on policy. We've got people who strictly focus on system of system, cybersecurity and system of system. Setting, which means then when you really look at the aviation infrastructure, we're talking about a large-scale system of system settings. Different systems of different kinds, they all come together, they all communicate. And so then the question becomes, how do you even provide a sliver of assurance of security in a system like this? So we also have folks, believe it or not, all the way to human factors. Because cybersecurity and human factors, believe it or not, they matter quite a bit. If you make a simple example would be if you make a password too complex and too long, people are simply going to write it down and put it in their drawer.
Yes.
Which means then. So that is the idea behind the center, and we would like to be the go-to place for cybersecurity issues in aviation and aerospace. That's our vision to be of service to the industry.
It's very comprehensive. It's always interesting to see how technologies, I'll just use that term really broadly, probably inappropriately, but when you're talking about a technology, whether that gets a focus in academic institutions as a topic, as a subject that you study, versus is it integrated into all the other topics. There's probably a little bit of both that's occurring here.
So there is a little bit of both. Today, if you say, even if we take physicians, a medical professional, they do need to be aware of a certain level of cybersecurity. If you think about, say, people who are working for airlines, they do need to get educated a little bit about cybersecurity. I don't want to take the subject into a political arena, but what happened in the elections was somebody clicked on a link. And so to prevent these things from happening, you do have to provide a certain level of education to people. This is no different than basic, say, safety education to everybody, workplace safety education to everybody, or basic diversity education to everybody at work, or simple skills that we all have to have. And for better or worse, cybersecurity is becoming one of them, because computers are everywhere and the computers are networked. And we do need their services, and we use their services. And so they are part of our societal infrastructure today, for better or worse. Well, of course, it's for the better. But so that also comes with certain requirements of educating the users, or educating everybody about implications of this reality. Aside from that, then we can take it back to the original question. So do you then just scratch the old systems and start with brand new, saying this is how we're going to build it? Or do you try to secure the old ones? Well, you have to do both. And for that, you really need engineering skills. How do I take a legacy system, and how do I, in some sense, reverse engineer, really, and understand it, and then understand how it can be broken, and then build defenses around it without destroying the core functionality, disturbing the core functionality of those systems? And then at the same time, how can I build security into the systems that I'm going to be building next? But all of this also has to be done in a cost-effective way, which is exactly one of the reasons why we're taking the engineering perspective to approach this problem.
I'm not sure if this is actually something that fits into what we're talking about, but it's something that's been on my mind for the last few weeks since that restriction went into place in the Middle East about people not being able to bring their laptops or iPads or anything like that on board anymore because of the fear of explosive devices in the shape of, well, I don't know, somehow that they would fit inside these devices. But, of course, the critics around the world have said, well, you know, it doesn't make any sense, because if those people were only coming from the Middle East, they could go through London or Paris or Frankfurt and come in. And so I'm just curious if the kind of systems that you work on look at those kinds of, I don't know if I'd call that a practical problem or an anomaly or what.
Okay, so I think I will refute that claim. Somebody being able to go to, let's say person A had a certain amount of explosive implanted into a computer. Let's make that assumption. And the person from that country flew to, say, London. Well, when that person is in London, that person will have to go through security check again. And this is a matter of trust to the origin. Because we trust London, we also trust that London would catch that when that person goes through the security check again. And indeed, when you go to Europe, right before you board an aircraft that is to come to the United States, because I did change planes in Amsterdam quite a few times and other places, you go through security check again. And so this is the trust we place in our allies that they would be able to catch that. But
I understand that. At this point, we don't really know what we're looking for in that particular situation, do we?
I guess I am lost about questions. So at this time,
well, I guess, you know, I understand that when somebody comes from London or one of the other European cities or Asia or anywhere, they're going to go through additional security checks, just like
Correct.
We would if we go there. But I'm saying that if we're not sure what we're looking for, I guess I'm trying to figure out how the security system can do its job.
Rob, your fallacy there is we don't know what we're looking for.
I would disagree. We know what we're looking for. The question is, we in this specific case, we didn't trust the specific origins that they would do a thorough job in checking those devices.
Wow. I guess I just find that so odd, because one of the areas where I've seen lots of security is coming through Dubai. And one of the few cities in the world that I've seen that check your bags after you get to the city, before you can even get your hands on them. I guess I just wondered where suddenly everyone decided that cities like that were no longer safe.
I don't know. I guess part of it is the employee vetting process. Part of it may be that if those checks and balances are not applied to everybody in an equal way, maybe I really cannot make that judgment.
Okay.
But as to the devices that do the detection of those type of substances, they do work well. But having said that, just like in radar systems, you do have to tune the false detection with, say, a false positive versus a false negative. So you do have to make that balance, and any type of system, be it a radar system, be it a virus detector, has got a small chance of a false negative, which means missing the artifact that was being looked for. That's a reality. That's the reality of any type of system that we design and implement. And so with that, these are very difficult. So it all really comes down to as good as it gets. And I do believe that's what they are trying to do when they come up with this type of policies.
Mm. Mm. Okay.
Yeah. In some ways, we're just scratching the surface here. But I think what it's illustrated is sort of the scope and complexity of the issues here. Just kind of difficult to get your arms around sometimes. But with all the different branches and issues and sub questions and things.
Correct. And we haven't even talked about the UAVs.
Yes. David and I have a...
That could be a whole other podcast.
Yes, we have another podcast that focuses on those. And maybe we can get connected and explore that there. But since we're running out of time a little bit here, I'll say that we'll put a link in the show notes to the Cybase Center. Of course, that's the Cybersecurity and Assured Systems Engineering Center. Remzi, is that kind of a good starting point for our audience?
Correct. That would be fantastic. And if somebody has additional questions, they are welcome to email me. So.
That's great. There's a lot of resources, a lot of links on that page, on the Embry-Riddle page for the Cybase Center. And we encourage all of you to take a look at that and explore, think about some of these areas. And of course, we have a number of younger listeners who are always thinking about careers in aviation. And of course, we've talked about Embry-Riddle many times, had a number of other people from Embry-Riddle on the show. But here's another area within the scope of aviation that maybe lines up with your interests and is something to explore. So again, look for the Cybase Center link on the webpage. Well, Remzi, again, thanks so much for coming on the show. It was a fascinating conversation. I'm really glad you're able to join us, and thanks. And maybe we'll be able to have some additional conversations in the future.
I'm looking forward to it. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
All right, let's do a quick What's Up with the Geeks. I say quick every week, but sometimes it's not so quick. Let's see. Let's start with Rob. Rob, are you doing anything aviation-wise that's interesting?
No, absolutely nothing aviation-wise except sitting in the back of a Southwest Airlines airplane tomorrow morning, headed to Los Angeles for some fun. The young lady that is our daughter is about to graduate from college.
Ooh, yeah.
And she has gotten herself into something I find unbelievable. She's gotten into comedy, and she's gotten into stand-up, and she has a stand-up gig out in Santa Monica this
week.
So we're, yeah.
Who the heck did she learn that from, Rob?
I don't know, because obviously nobody in our family has a sense of humor. And all I know is that I hope to God, her jokes are better than mine, as everyone who's listening right now is saying, amen. So anyway, but it should be a lot of fun.
And Rob, I thought you were coming out here to see me.
Sorry, oh. Brian.
or more to the point, where the heck did that 4 years go?
Oh, yeah. You're not kidding. It's funny. I remember when we were talking to Dan, when Dan Webb was still around, and we were talking to him about, you know, a daughter getting ready to go to college because he hadn't been out that long. And now that seems like ancient history.
It does. It really does.
And Rob, you know where new comedians get all their material, right? They just talk about their families. So expect to hear yourself in the routine.
That's true. You're in trouble, Rob. You're in big trouble.
You are.
Max Trescott, what's going on in your world?
Oh, my gosh. I am just so busy. I had 3 flights yesterday, 2 flights today, and then 2 podcasts today, right? This one and yeah. Aviation News Talk. But on the looking forward, I'm headed to Phoenix this coming weekend, picking up a Cirrus that a local person bought, and we're bringing it back home together, and then we will teach her instrument rating in that Cirrus. So that's going to be fun. The following weekend, I'm headed out to Knoxville, Tennessee. I've never been there before. But I will be teaching at the Cirrus CPPP, which is the Cirrus Pilot Proficiency Program, which is right. Kind of a boot camp for Cirrus owners and renter pilots. And I get to be one of the drill sergeants there. So it's really a great weekend for anybody that's flying Cirrus and wants to become, you know, kind of really master the airplane. It combines 2 days of ground instruction, you know, presentations with two-hour flights. So I do these a couple of times a year. So it's kind of the national pilot proficiency program, and this year I became a platinum CSIP, which yes. That means I get a different badge now when I'm teaching at these. So anyway, that's great fun. And then finally, I was going to take a twin this week to Texas, but it looks like that's become a trip to Canada. So man, I'm just flying everywhere in the next couple of weeks.
Wow, very nice. And Knoxville's great. Hope you have time to enjoy the town while you're
I'm
there.
Going out a day early specifically for that.
Perfect, perfect. Brian, what's new with you?
Oh, I had an interesting experience coming back from Toronto. So if you remember last week, I did a quick trip up there. Hadn't been to Toronto in quite some time. And on the way back Thursday, the weather was pretty bad in Toronto and they canceled a whole bunch of flights and was on the phone for, I don't know, 45 minutes, 50 minutes talking with a customer service agent. And by that time, I had gotten up to my place in line to talk with the ticket counter person. And she looked at my record and I'd been put on hold by the regular reservationist. So she looked at my record and said, why in the world is this person putting you on a flight to Minneapolis on Delta when you're going to miss connect? Let me just put you on an Air Canada flight.
Hmm.
And I said, okay, that. And she said, you know, takes off in 45 minutes or so. And it was a nonstop flight, which was great. And she prints out the boarding pass and hands it to me. And I even got upgraded. So
nice.
Well done for disasters in Toronto. And I got to check out the first class product on Air Canada. So I got to fly on a 767. It was not necessarily the most modern interior, but the flight crew did a really good job and I made it home and all is good. So kind of happy.
Great. Wonderful. Wonderful. Looking at some upcoming aviation events, things where some of us are going to be attending or plan to, we have Wings Over Pittsburgh coming up May 13th and 14th. That's going to be a great show. David, we're going to have there will be a lot of notable aviation podcasters attending or planning to anyway.
Yeah, it should be a good time. It's going to be we're going to commit podcast as some of those.
I like that.
Airline pilot guy is leading it. You and I will be there. Brian will be there. Micah will be there, and we're looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to going back to one of my old haunts, the 911th, which was one of my father's sister squadron flight with the 913th. So I used to hang out at Pittsburgh, look at 130s. So I'm looking, they're losing their 130s and getting C-17s. I'm kind of sad about that. But so looking forward to a weekend of air showing and podcasting, big podcast at the Marriott on Saturday night.
And then, of course, we have the Innovations in Flight Day coming up June 17th. That's the annual event held by the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum at the Stephen Udvar-Hazy Center adjacent to Dulles Airport. I think you'll find at least a couple of us attending that again this year. So we look forward to seeing you there. And we always have a dinner afterwards. David, are you going to be there?
I will be there.
I will. Any of you other guys? Max T? It's kind of far away for you and Brian, and I don't know if you'll be able to make it or not.
Yeah, I'm not going to make it this year, I'm afraid, but like to someday.
All right. Also,
well, I wish I could come.
Go ahead.
I was going to say I wish I could come, but the Pittsburgh event happens the same time when my youngins graduating from college, so that took care of that one.
Mm.
And then the event in June, unfortunately, I'm going to be out of the country. So maybe next year.
Okay. One of the nice things about Innovations in Flight Day is that not only do you get to see all of the exhibits, of course, in the museum, but like ourselves, there are many other groups, people around the museum that set up displays or give talks or things. And so you get some kind of extra fun stuff to do. But another aspect of this is all the aircraft that come in special for the event parked outside. Now, I think we mentioned previously that Jonathan Baron is going to be bringing in his Shark. We had him on the show some weeks ago. And so you get to see the Shark. But we also just recently got word of another aircraft that'll be there. So let's listen to this.
Greetings, fellow Av Geeks. This is Hillel. Thought you'd like to know that our little Cherokee was selected by the Stephen F. Udvar-Hazy Center for being displayed at Innovations in Flight Day, Saturday, June 17th, the day before Father's Day. This is a great Father's Day gift for any Av Geek. And I'm looking forward to flying in again. It's a whole lot of fun to meet everyone at one of our original impromptu AvGeek meetups. Hope to see you then. Bring the family. Great for kids.
All right. Yeah, we saw Hillel there last year, so it'll be great for him to be able to fly in and join in the fun. We hope you can join us there. But then coming up after that, we have Air Venture, Oshkosh, July 24th through 30th. Rob, are you going to be able to make that this year?
I'm going to that, baby. Let me tell you. Who else is going? Okay. Well, that took care of that.
All right. Next year. Next year for sure. Another one in Pennsylvania, the Northeastern Pennsylvania Air Show. That's August 12th and 13th. This is looking to be something pretty spectacular. I know the F-22 demonstration team will be there. All of these you can find at a website. We have a calendar, aviation calendar website. We've talked about it before. You can find that at avgeekfests.com. Also, we'd invite you if you have events in your area, places where aviation professionals and enthusiasts can go and congregate and have a great time. Please visit that site and add that to the calendar. Look forward to that.
Hey, Max, one other air show that I'm planning on being at, if they have it, is the air show here in Chino.
Oh, the Chino show. Yes, it's. I guess that's any new developments on that?
Yeah, they got to stay until the 30th of April. So that's apparently when they're going to meet again. And that's kind of cutting it close because the show's scheduled for, is it the 6th and 7th?
Yep, I think so. Yeah, the judge.
So 6th and 7th. And I'm definitely going to be there on the 7th, assuming they have a show.
So the judge disqualified himself, which is why they had to find a new judge, which is why they kicked the can road, down the road a few more days.
Okay, interesting. All right, we have a listener recording. This is another memorable flight. As you know, we've been soliciting all of you to send in short recordings and describe some memorable flight that you've had in the past. So we heard from Trevor Smith, and he sent this along.
Hi, Airplane Geeks. This is Trevor with DesertPilot.com. And I heard that you were looking for stories of memorable flights. This is my very first really long trip in a 172 with my wife. We flew from the Phoenix area to Anaheim to go to Disneyland. And it was around New Year's, so the weather was beautiful. The flight over was uneventful. I had just gotten my private pilot license, and I had maybe 50, 60 hours underneath my belt. I definitely just had a license to learn. I made a lot of mistakes over there as well. Not, you know, too earth-shattering ones, but things like I leaned it a little too much. A few other just little things that how I approached and talked to the controllers and so forth that just kind of come with time. But made it over there. Was a beautiful flight. Flying through the Banning Pass into the L.A. Basin was definitely very cool. And, you know, all the traffic and... We landed at Fullerton, which is only about 5 or 6 miles from Disneyland, so spent the trip at Disneyland. On the way back was a little bit different. So we had rented a 172 that belonged to a friend in the area. So I did my thorough pre-flight. Everything checked out. It's just that there was a layer of fog in the area, and it was just a ground layer, actually, because it was clear about 500 feet above the ground. So, but it was just on the ground, and we were kind of waiting for it to clear, and eventually it did get to VFR minimums just barely, so we were climbing out. But by that time it was dusk, and you know, the sun was setting, so we had originally planned to leave in the afternoon, but now we're leaving, you know, closer to the evening. So We took off. I mean, it's the same route back. So we took off, and I was very worried about the fog, but actually it turned out to be not that big of a deal. So we got up above it. It was very clear, and I could see, you know, I could see everything, but the sun was setting behind us. And we were flying along, and I realized I really got to go to the bathroom. So my wife, now that this is the second leg of our trip, she had been flying with me. I think this is a total of three times. She's starting to get settled in and falling asleep. And I'm flying along, and we're up over Blythe, up at cruising altitude, which is about halfway. It's right on the border of Arizona and California. And I'm looking down at the airport at Blythe, and I think, man, I really gotta pee. And I can laugh about it now, but at the time I was like, oh no, I think I can make it. So I'm flying along, and by this time it's dark. It's nighttime, so we got our lights on, and this older 172, although it was qualified for night, the inside panel was very dimly lit. You could read the instruments well enough, but it wasn't like anything spectacular. So we're flying along, and it's just getting worse. I mean, it doesn't get any better when you got to go to the bathroom. It's just getting worse and worse. You know, I'm dancing and moving, and then all of a sudden I'm to the point where I can start to see the lights of Phoenix, you know, coming up, and I'm looking at my GPS, and I'm looking, and then, you know, I'm still a good, you know, 20, 30 minutes out at least. And it gets to the point where I can't even think straight anymore. I'm looking forward, and I can't think of anything. I'm trying to, you know, figure out what I need to do next, look at my GPS, look at my, you know, try to stay ahead of the airplane. And all I can think about is, you have to go to the bathroom so bad. So, I mean, I'm already beyond dancing. I'm already beyond, you know, shaking, and literally my hands physically start shaking. And I'm like, oh crap, I have to do something. So, and you know, being the novice pilot that I was, I kind of let it get to this point, which was not really a good idea, because So my wife, sitting next to me, has been asleep for a little while, and I'm at the point of, you know, that I'm just either going to, you know, pee all over everything or I got to find something. So instead of, you know, nudging her gently and saying, honey, why don't you, could you find a bag for me or something like that? No, no. I shake her very violently, according to her, at least, and I say, babe, grab the controls. Grab the controls. I got to find something. She's, of course, being woken up, being told to grab the controls. In her mind, she thinks that the plane's going down and we're just about to crash, and I tell her to grab the controls. And so she's bawling. She immediately starts crying, thinking that this is the end, and I'm like rummaging in the back in our bag, frantically trying to find a plastic bag so I can relieve myself. And she's, and by the time she figured everything out, I had already relieved myself in the bag and taken the controls back, but she's never let me live that down. But that was definitely one of the most memorable flights. And surprisingly enough, she is still gone flying with me again. Not as much maybe as I'd like, but she still trusts me. And I've definitely made the choice to buy, have plastic bags ready, and also they have, you know, special bags that are specially designed for instances just like that. And I make sure I have at least a couple in my pilot bag when I fly.
All right. I bet you only go unprepared for that situation once.
And that is essentially almost stand-up right there. I mean, you know, that would I would suggest, Trevor, if you haven't heard the Moth Radio Hour on NPR, where people get up and tell really interesting, engaging stories about far-out topics, go listen to it, because I'm telling you, that is meant for Moth Radio. It was great.
All right. So, of course, if you have a memorable flight, something from the past that you'd like to send in, we'd love for you to do that. You can make a simple recording on your phone. If you need some help figuring out how to make a recording, just let us know, and we'll sort of help you out with that. And maybe you'll find yourself on an episode of the Airplane Geeks. Moving on to some listener mail. Ted wrote us. He was talking about our conversation about thrust reversers. And he says the older style JT8 thrust reversers are known as a clamshell design. The later types are known as a cascade design. And that's a term that I embarrassingly couldn't think of at the time. Ted says, FYI, the C-17 has an interesting and very effective cascade system where it can back up when fully loaded. And of course, the engine on this C-17 is the Pratt & Whitney F-117 PW-100, which is essentially the same as a PW-2000 series engine that you find on the Boeing 757. So unlike many other military engine programs where the engine is pretty much unique to the military, this particular engine is mostly a commercial engine, but from Pratt & Whitney, they describe the C-17 F-117 engine says are equipped with a directed flow thrust reverser capable of being deployed in flight. On the ground, the thrust reverser can back a fully loaded aircraft up a 2-degree slope. Which, David, I guess comes in pretty handy for some of the missions that the C-17s fly.
It was my very first experience with the C-17 was at Andrews Air Force Base. And they had it opened up for tours. Then they suddenly whisked everybody off and proceeded to rope off the area and then back the aircraft out onto the runway, take off and fly its demo. It's the first time I've ever seen that happen, where the static display aircraft became the demo aircraft and back. And watching it back out of its parking spot was very impressive. That was my first very impressive thought about the C-17. And yes, for short fields, it's very important to be able to hit those thrust reversers the moment you hit the ground to slow out your roll. There's some really good footage if you go out and look at C-17s, usually at Red Flag where they're out at one of the remote fields. And it is kind of cool watching the rooster tail of dirt come up behind a C-17 as it hits the thrust reversers.
Oh, we also heard from Bob. He wrote us and sent an article from MRO Network. This is predicting when commercial airlines will be torn down. And he sent along, there's a photo in the article that shows an old 747-400 that's in the process of being torn down, scavenged for parts and so forth. In the background, there's the nose of another airplane. And Bob was asking, is that a Dreamliner waiting to be scrapped? So we've had some conversation about just what this airplane is. I think most people think it's not a 787 because of the number of panels in the cockpit windows. It doesn't look like it lines up with what a 787 would have. Maybe it's a 757. And I think, Rob, as you pointed out, just because it's there doesn't mean it's there to be torn down.
And I wonder if it is a 787, I wonder if it's one of the ones that was overweight, you know, what did they call the original 8?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The overweight 8 or the ugly 8 or no, something. I can't remember what it is, but it could be one of those as well.
The process of repairing, making, you know, fuselage repairs on a composite body aircraft are, of course, a lot different than aluminum. And I think that basically to replace a section, you know, to cut out a damaged section and replace it, you have to start with, you know, like the barrel, the original barrel, and then cut a section out of that. So, yeah, if 787s do become surplus, then they would be a good source for those kinds of patch materials, certainly. It's an interesting article. I will put it in the show notes. Because it notes that the commercial airline fleet is expected to grow to more than 35,000 aircraft by 2027. But here's the key part. 50% of those will be replacing in-service units. So the question is, what happens to all those other airplanes? Well, it talks about this air salvage in the UK. They're booking teardowns for 747-400s, for 777-300s. They're only averaging 19 to 23 years old. And so these become good sources of used serviceable material, which can have an interesting impact on the market. I remember towards the end of the JT8D days when the 727 was being replaced by more modern aircraft, there were huge numbers of surplus, well, the 727s, but also the JT8D engines, which kind of killed the spare parts business for the OEM because there's so much serviceable material out there that can be used at a much lower cost than buying a brand new spare part. So with so much of the fleet scheduled to be replaced with new aircraft, I think that's going to have a huge impact on the spare parts market. The used serviceable guys are going to enjoy, I think, some really good times, and the OEMs, not so much. So that'll be something to watch.
You know, there's another aspect of that. He says the commercial fleet will grow by, 35,000 aircraft. I wonder if he's just kind of projecting current sales rates. There have been two announcements recently that Boeing is laying people off. I really think we're starting to get to the end of this buy cycle, and that airlines may have enough stuff on order. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in the next couple of years. But I'm thinking that, orders are going to be harder to come by for the airframers.
I would think so as well. I mean, I think a lot of sold capacity is out there, and the appetite for additional capacity is, I think, going to be limited. And, you can replace so many old aircraft with newer, more efficient ones, but, the economics of doing that only works out for so many aircraft, not the entire fleet.
Well, the airlines might be doing it to themselves as well, too, because they've been trying to keep capacity constrained so that utilization is high and they keep prices high. And, you know, they keep trying to raise prices. They're going to find at some point demand's going to fall off a little bit. So there's only so much milk they're going to get out of this cow, I think.
And just finally make mention, wanted to thank AFW105 for his or her review in iTunes. Always greatly appreciated. It's helpful when people are looking at podcasts in iTunes, for example, and in other places that have reviews, if they can learn a little bit about what other listeners think about the show before they listen or subscribe. So thank you, AFW105, and all the others who've put in reviews for the Airplane Geeks podcast in iTunes. Really appreciate it. All right, that's going to do it for this episode. We want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. As always, you can find us at airplanegeeks.com. If you want to go straight to the show notes for this episode, that's airplanegeeks.com/449. We very much want to thank our guest, Dr. Ramzi Seeker, a professor in the Department of Electrical, Computer, Software, and Systems Engineering at the Embry-Riddle College of Engineering.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you again. We really appreciate it.
It was a true pleasure. I enjoyed it.
Great. All right. Well, let's tell everybody where they can find us online. So, Rob Mark, we'll start with you.
What if we didn't tell people this every week? Everybody knows where we are, right?
We've had that comment before. Yeah, what happens
is... Oh, have
we? Yeah, And then if we don't say it for a few weeks, then we get the other side of it, which is, how come you don't tell us where we can find you anymore? So,
okay, so what I could say is, it's me, Rob Mark. Guess who, guess where?
Okay,
that wouldn't work either. Okay. They can find me anywhere that has Jet Wine in the title, or certainly in between the pages of Flying Magazine online or at your newsstand.
Good. And Max Trescott.
Well, the best place to find me now these days is AviationNewsTalk.com, the name of my general aviation podcast, and episode 6 will be out by the time folks are listening to this. If they want to contact me, just click on the contact link on that page, and also if you want to check out my online courses for things like the Garmin G1000 and flying GPS with WASS approaches, you can find that link on that website as well.
Cool. Brian Coleman, how do folks reach you?
Oh, the best place to find me will be at LAX or by sending me an email to brian@airplanegeeks.com.
And David Vanderhoof.
Well, you can find my blog on our website at airplanegeeks.com, which just flew by. And, of course, you can always find me on Friday mornings with that guy, Max Flight, talking about high-gain antennas and UAVs.
Yeah. All right, you can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. Look for me on LinkedIn, as David said, at the UAVDigest.com. Also with Mary Kirby at PaxXPodcast.com. Our intro music is by Brother Love. Find him at BrotherLoveRocks.com. Outro by Bruno Massone. Find his musical compositions at BrunoMassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Good night, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Thanks for listening.
Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Good night, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Keep the blue side up.
He stole my line again.
Yeah, but I can fix it. Go ahead, David.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening back.
Okay, good.